I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few moments, should screening for postpartum depression be mandatory? But first, the governor of Illinois is painting his state's historic $13 billion budget deficit in stark terms.
We are in a crisis of epic proportions.
In a risky election year gambit, Governor Patrick Quinn told state lawmakers yesterday that they must pass an increase in the personal income tax to avoid laying off up to 17,000 public school teachers. Quinn's Republican opponent, Bill Brady, called it scare tactics. But this week, the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities reported that since the recession started, 13 states have upped the personal income tax. So how will this go over in Illinois? Ray Long is State House reporter for the Chicago Tribune in Springfield. Ray, the governor's been here before, right, asking for a tax increase?
Yes, he has. In fact, what he's called for this time around is a modest reduction in what he called for last time. What he wants to do is raise the flat personal income tax in Illinois from 3% to 4%. So in other words, that's a 33% jump.
Right.
And also, he wants to increase the corporate tax from 4.8% to 5.8%. There's a whole bunch of reaction here, and it runs the gamut. Yes, it's time to stand up lawmakers and do the right thing and plug the hole to, holy smokes, why are we raising the taxes now in the middle of a bad economy?
Right. Well, and why is he asking for it? What else is he saying besides feeling he has to let public teachers go?
Well, his gambit, as you were calling it, is to put the cuts on education. That's a way to kind of put the pain, if you will, in one of the most meaningful areas of state budgeting. This is the kind of thing that Joe Lunchbox understands, and Quinn is saying he wants to cut $1.3 billion from education levels that are in place now. So to give you some perspective, the state puts about $7 billion, a little over $7 billion, into schools right now. That's just the state portion. It would bring it down to somewhere around the $6 billion level. Part of it would also be hitting on higher education, but the big focus here is on elementary and high school education.
Well, as we heard, his Republican opponent in the November election, Bill Brady, said this is just a scare tactic, a catastrophe that would push jobs out of the state. But we're also seeing stories almost every day, whole high school staffs being fired in Rhode Island. Half of the schools are going to be closed in Kansas City, Missouri. So what is your sense from your perspective? Is this as epic a problem as Quinn is saying?
Well, it's definitely the biggest budget dilemma they've had for years, if not ever. What the situation appears to me is that, city budgets are hurting. They want more from the state. The state wants to cut some from the money they send to the cities. The cities are looking to the feds for more. The states are looking for the feds for more. Everybody's looking to everybody else for some kind of financial boost.
And part of what this has produced is an anti-incumbency mood. You've not got just one race in November. You've got another big one for Senator Roland Burris' seat. How do you think this is going to play out?
Well, definitely Democrats are worried here in Illinois that the anti-incumbent mood, as you just mentioned, is going to play against Democrats. They could lose the chief executive office. They could lose some other statewide offices. And it may have a rollover effect on the race between Alexei Giannoulis, who is the state treasurer running for the U.S. Senate, versus Mark Kirk, who is a congressman, the Republican candidate for U.S. Senate.
Right. On the other hand, could Governor Quinn look like a grown-up who's addressing severe financial problems?
Well, that's what he's definitely trying to say. Look, I'm trying to speak reality to you. You know, Governor Quinn was lieutenant governor to Rod Blagojevich, and Rod Blagojevich, you probably know, was impeached, ousted, and indicted on corruption charges. Governor Quinn has been trying to burnish his image as a straight shooter populist, and is trying to tell people, look, I'm giving it to you straight. It's tough medicine, but you have to swallow it.
That's Ray Long, State House reporter for the Chicago Tribune. He's been speaking to us from Springfield, Illinois. Ray, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Good to be here.
Well, to the question now that's being asked at a state and federal level, should new moms be screened for postpartum depression? About 85% of new mothers experience some kind of mood disturbance, a baby blues, usually short-lived. But for 1 in 10 new moms, it gets worse, postpartum depression. And there are moves to legislate awareness, screening, and treatment. Well, is this a simple and potentially life-saving, long-overdue idea? Or an overreaction an overburdened healthcare system can ill afford, backed by pharmaceutical companies trying to get moms on meds? That's the debate. Jean Watson Driscoll joins us. She went through postpartum depression about 4 decades ago. Now she treats women. She's a doctor and co-author of the book Postpartum Mood and Anxiety Disorders, A Guide. Doctor, may I call you Jean?
Sure, please.
Jean, Dr. Driscoll, welcome.
Thank you. It's
so
nice to be here.
Let's first just get you on this debate. Where do you stand?
I feel strongly that women are not being identified, and women therefore are silenced, and they're going without treatment in a disorder that we can treat and we can have happy endings with.
Okay.
And so, having been involved with this for over 30 years, it's very frustrating that this is 2010 and we still have women not being heard.
Well, let's find out more about why you feel so strongly. First, with your personal experience, you were a nurse at the time, and so did you recognize your own symptoms?
I was a nurse. I had a much-wanted pregnancy, much-wanted baby, and it was a lot of anxiety with strange thoughts about weird things potentially happening to my daughter.
Doesn't that happen all the time? Doesn't every new mom have that? Well, to differentiate for us, when did you know it was postpartum depression?
Well, there is a spectrum, Robin, of disorders that go. There's the baby blues, which is kind of the least severe, and then you can go all the way up to postpartum psychosis, which is where a woman loses touch with reality.
We understand postpartum psychosis happens in maybe 1 in 500 to 1,000 moms.
Correct.
And they really are gone.
They need psychiatric emergency care.
Yeah.
Then the in-between spectrum are women who experience mood or anxiety disorders during this postpartum period, though there are about 10 to 15% of women who experience it in pregnancy. And then it gets exacerbated or worse in postpartum.
So tell us more about what that is. What does that feel like?
You can present with symptoms of mood changes, irritability, a lot of anxiety that women didn't have before. A little bit of rage at times, crying, lack of confidence, feeling like, why did I do this? Worried about something happening to themselves or the baby. Lots of sleep disorders. Women can't sleep or they sleep all the time. Women feeling very physically changed, headaches, diarrhea.
A lot of us feel that we have maybe watched this in other people, and it gets assigned to sort of, oh, what a person with a hormonal balance, but maybe not put in a nice way. And it sometimes, well, tell us, how sometimes are women viewed who have these feelings?
Well, we have this media myth that anyone who has a baby should be happy. So God forbid you say that you're not doing as well as everyone expected. And I need to add in there, too, that this can occur in women who adopt children, too, because of some of the biochemistry that goes on with this.
In other words, your body doesn't know you're adopting. It just knows this precious child has come into your life, so your body will change.
Well, most of these women that go into adoption have histories of infertility, so they've had other hormonal assaults to their body with going through infertility, probably have some history of anxiety or depression that may or may not have been treated. What's very interesting, Robin, is often people don't necessarily think they have a psychiatric disorder if they've never been on medication. So I've learned to ask women, have you had any problems with feeling moody or up and down or angry, rather than asking about a psychiatric history, because unless they've seen a psychiatrist, they tend to say no.
As we continue to find out more about what postpartum depression is, we do hear that the women likeliest to have it have had some form of depression, even though they may not have defined it as that in the past. Mm-hmm. So what is happening in their bodies? What's going on?
Well, we really haven't, in research base, haven't come up with a pure one-dimensional etiology to postpartum depressive disorder. There seems to be similar correlations with the neurotransmitters that goes on with depression, but what happens is this rapid assault to the body secondary to the hormones that drop to the lowest level they've ever dropped after someone has a baby and delivers the placenta. So perhaps for some women, that rapid change dysregulates some of the neurotransmitters in their brain, leading to some of these more exaggerated mood symptoms.
And it sounds like you're also saying that if they have feelings of not being able to do this, maybe if they weren't mothered, I mean, there might be other things besides chemistry that then will get kicked in, whatever vulnerabilities they have in mentally.
Exactly, because this is a multi-ideology right. disorder.
Right.
If someone has a history of post-traumatic stress disorder from physical or emotional abuse, someone has lost their mother at a very early age, those are psychological or psychodynamic issues that can affect becoming a mother. So you have to look for all the pieces to come up with a good diagnosis and then a treatment plan.
Well, and that brings us to some of the legislation that hopes to do that. Let's start with a state bill. Here in Massachusetts, there's a proposal that would mandate that every woman, every pregnant woman, would be screened during her pregnancy and the year after childbirth, and that the screening would be covered by insurance. Now, this is where a lot of people get stuck. Every single woman, your thoughts on that?
Every single woman who's pregnant and postpartum is at risk for the exacerbation of something if she's had anything before. Which means if a woman enters pregnancy with a history of mood or anxiety disorders, treated or not treated, they are at risk for that to be exacerbated during the pregnancy and postpartum. So to do the screening, and there the Edinburgh Postpartum Depression Screening Scale is the one that has been around the longest since 1986. It's got excellent validations and sensitivity and specificity, and it's a 10-item pencil paper questionnaire. So the woman responds to how she's felt over the past 2 weeks. What happens with that, if she gets a score of 12 or higher, then that leads that she's experiencing some difficulty, some problems.
Okay, stop right there. Because a lot of people haven't been through this, but they might assume, why do you need a bill to legislate that? Doesn't a doctor say to his or her patient who's pregnant, how are you feeling?
I would tell you, yes, most everybody says, how are you feeling? And most people say, fine. So what we need to say then is, tell me how you're really feeling. Many women, after they have babies, cry a lot or feel a little bit like they don't have any confidence. How are you feeling? Have you been crying? Do you feel as though you're getting a little irritable? Ways to collect more data rather than, we have a culture that everybody's fine.
But again, it goes back to, this is something that would mandate screening that would be covered by insurance. Afterwards, women would be given referral lists of clinicians and support groups. And as we said, they'd be checked up on a year later. Isn't there another less expensive way to do this, which is to just have a full frontal assault education campaign so that everybody understands and everyone in the family, people know what to look for? And it doesn't have to be this kind of, you know, you get the insurance coverage. It's more in the culture.
That would be great if we could say that, because part of the bill is not only to screen, but to educate and to develop a referral list. But having been involved in this for 30 years, some people want to do it and some people don't. Some people are afraid of psychiatric questions in the healthcare field. You know, if I ask somebody, do you feel like hurting yourself? And she says, yes, what am I going to do with that data? So oftentimes, if I don't ask, then I don't have to know. But women then will drop cues and hints to their healthcare providers, like, well, you know, haven't slept for a few days. And what they'll hear, and some of these are quotes, oh, this is hormonal, it'll go away. Maybe you need to go out on a date. And so what happens is things are kind of sloughed around and not validated as important. And she's very concerned that she hasn't slept in 2 or 3 days. So we need to be listening differently.
That's Jean Watson Driscoll, an expert in postpartum depression. By the way, I think I said that doctors should ask a doctor should ask his or her patient who is pregnant. I'm well aware that would be a big story. We're, of course, speaking about new moms and should they be screened for postpartum depression. When we come back, the criticism that this would be pushing them onto medication. In 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation about postpartum depression. There's a bill in Congress to address education, and there's a bill pending here in Massachusetts that would mandate screening. Let's stay there with Dr. Jean Watson-Driscoll, who treats women here in the Boston area. And Jean, before the break, you said healthcare providers need to listen more carefully because, for instance, here in Massachusetts, there are programs in place.
We're doing very well in many ways. What's very sad to me is when I get the call from women who said, I've seen 3 or 4 people and no one has helped me. So there's a struggle because people assume that postpartum mood and anxiety disorders are similar to any other depressive disorder. The reality is, if a woman did not have a new baby, it would be a very different way to treat her than if she has a brand new baby.
Right.
She has to get well quickly because she has to attach and bond with that child. We now know that maternal attachment and mother and in-face or eye-to-eye contact with infants is so important for their brain development.
In fact, some studies show that children of women who have had postpartum depression, those children are more likely to get into trouble as they get older. You're nodding yes. But staying with some of these state proposals, in 2006, New Jersey enacted landmark legislation. These women would be screened before they leave the hospital.
Correct.
But some people there say there's some growing pains. I mean, one complaint, the mandated help hotline is staffed by people without experience in mental health crisis. You're nodding yes. Another complaint is that not enough OBGYNs take it seriously. So it goes back to, is this going to be just another piece of paper that the insurance company's going to get tons of money for? But if you don't have doctors who are educated, it doesn't work.
It's very hard to just enact a bill and have it be put into play.
Right.
So what's happened in New Jersey is they now have regional consortiums that are doing more to educate and educate and educate the healthcare providers in the areas. The issue, too, is developing lists of referral networks is it's kind of an underground network. You know, people are on it, then they're off it. And so trying to find good people to refer to who look at this as a holistic disorder, because the treatment of choice depends on the severity of the symptoms. So there's a spectrum of treatment choices, too. Some women with mild depression can do well with cognitive behavioral therapy, with talk therapy. Some women where the biology is a little more dysregulated may require medication. But it's not an all-or-nothing thing. And often that's what you hear, that we're going to have all mothers on medication. I prescribe medication, and I will tell you, not all mothers are on medication.
Well, what about that criticism that this is just a move to go back to the 50s and 60s and get more mom to take a little pill?
No, I don't think that pills are given out that easily. At least I know in my practice they're not given out that easily. What you have to do is a good assessment. There needs to be a complete assessment so that you're ruling out depression as well as bipolar disorder, which has a different treatment plan. You also then need to educate women and their families about what you're doing, why they're taking it, what it's going to do. And there needs to be, in my mind, weekly follow-up on that. I will not prescribe medication without therapy in my practice. I need to see women. I do a lot of bonding attachment work, a lot of psychological education about new motherhood and fatherhood. And I just feel like this is a time where so many women are left in the lurch because everyone says, oh, you had a baby. How lucky. Isn't that good? You truly get more support if you have a heart attack. You can go then to cardiac rehab and get all kinds of support and education. When you have a baby, it's kind of like good luck. You've been working nonstop. You stop work the day you deliver the baby. Now you're off for 6 to 8 weeks. It took 9 months to make this baby. We expect in 6 to 8 weeks that she's physically recovered and psychologically all set. It doesn't make sense to me.
What about some of the other concerns? If screening is mandated, you'll have just many more false positives. And again, just piling on an overworked healthcare system.
You have to remember, Robin, we're talking about screening. So this is not a diagnostic tool. So if someone scores high, they need to then be evaluated by someone who knows how to evaluate for psychiatric illness. So that if you get a false positive, I mean, we don't control how people answer pencil paper tests. You know, how do they read them? How do they respond? So it needs someone then to see her to make an evaluation. You can assess some of that on the phone. There are other studies that have used that screening tool with phone assessments. And then the key is having a referral source that she can be seen relatively quickly. Again, because time is of the essence when you have a mom and a new baby.
Yeah. Well, so we've been talking about state measures to mandate that all pregnant women have some form of screening for postpartum depression. But then there's also the federal measure. Now, this is the Melanie Blocker-Stokes Postpartum Depression Research and Care Act. It's known as the Mother's Act, but it's named after a young woman who killed herself. She had that third category we were talking about, the postpartum psychosis. I know you've met her mother. Have you met other women with postpartum psychosis, and how does that feel?
And we're moving into a totally different diagnosis
now. Totally different,
now,
yeah.
Because often women with postpartum psychosis untreated have the potential more so for infanticide than for suicide.
Terrible, terrible, yeah.
So what usually you hear people, the stories of Andrea Yates.
But who killed her five children.
Who killed her five children. And she was never correctly, if you look at the transcripts, treated with the correct medication. She had a bipolar disorder, which is generally the underlying disorder in a postpartum psychosis. And this is where assessment is so important, to pick up the nuances in the diagnosis, because the treatments are so different. So with this bill pending, the Mother's Act, this has been going on for a few years. Again, looking at education, it's not so much forcing screening as it is looking into education and resources and grant money to increase the research in the field of pregnancy and postpartum mood and anxiety disorders.
But, you know, there's a screening aspect to the federal law, and that's why a lot of people are against it. Again, Time magazine phrases it this way, the people who are they see it as potentially dangerous medicalization of motherhood, just pushing them onto meds.
I mean, I wish that we didn't have to legislatively mandate anything. I wish that women were looked at holistically when they come into an office being pregnant, so that not only with their uterus and their fetal development measured, but their mental status, their mental health. How are you doing? How's life treating you? Because each one of us are a brain and a body. And we need to do more with looking at how are we coping with the stressors that are induced with this physiological change. So if we had that as a given, I don't think we'd have this mandated screening issue. I'm not all for mandating anything, but it's better than nothing if we at least get people to talk and listen and maybe get women identified so that nothing bad happens to them.
That's Dr. Jean Watson Driscoll, who specializes in treating women. Dr. Driscoll, Jean, thanks so much for talking to us about all this.
Oh, thank you so much for even doing this show, Robin.
Well, and we'd love to know what you think. Just go to hereandnow.org. You can click on Contact Us. You can send us an email or make a phone call, and you can scroll down and leave a comment right there. Let us know what you think about the ideas discussed. Hereandnow.org. Tomorrow on Here and Now, food writer Corby Cummer has a grocery smackdown. He pits Whole Foods against Walmart's tomorrow. Here and Now. Russian hackers have earned the dubious reputation as some of the best criminal minds in cyberspace. The first big hack out of the region came in 1999 when the computer system of Bloomberg, the financial news service, was penetrated. The BBC's Sarah Rainsford traveled to Siberia to find out what makes Russians such good hackers.
I'm outside Tomsk State University now, founded in 1878. In fact, the first university in Russia to open to the east of the Urals. Now, one fact that anyone here in Tomsk will tell you is that every fifth resident of this city is actually a student. Now, that means there's an enormous young population here and a huge amount of brain power.
But it's information technology that this frozen Siberian city excels in. The teaching is very formal here. It's a bit old-fashioned, but it's solid. And yet, inside these classrooms, I met students like Alexei.
Hacking is an art. It's the art of breaking into something. A true hacker strives to learn something new. It's the art of constantly achieving new heights of expertise.
Like many of his IT-obsessed friends, Alexei sees no problem with breaking and entering in the virtual world.
You can do something dumb like hack a site, for example. Just take it out of action with an attack. Or you can come at it a different way. Maybe try to get hold of the administrator's password or use brute force. There are many methods. Some nice ones, when you let the server survive, and others which are total destruction.
I asked Alexei if he learns all this in class.
That's against the law. Anything we want to achieve, we do ourselves. The Institute just sets us on the right path. They don't teach us, look, you need to hack. They say, learn the law for this area first. The university tells us that hacking is a possibility, but that it's against the law.
So crime is not quite on the curriculum here. But there are plenty of opportunities to practice hacking at clubs run on campus.
Usually we have training every week, and it lasts 4 or 5 hours. But sometimes the game's so interesting, we get held up even longer.
Zhenya and his teammates are busy honing their skills for international information protection competitions. They're consistently among the top 3 teams in the world. As the session starts, Zhenya tells me the aim is to find flaws in your opponent's cyber defenses, then hack your way in. He soon strikes gold.
I found a type of vulnerability that allows somebody to get access to database and to get some data.
So you've managed to break into their system?
I can read all the data that are stored in their database.
So each one of these lines is a piece of information that you can steal from your opponent. Is it easy to find these vulnerabilities?
I don't know how it is in the real world, but here it is quite easy.
And you're never tempted to try attacking something real?
No, I think it's not a good way. The game is enough.
Hacking is a sport for these students. As Zhenia explains, you can't possibly defend a system well until you understand how to attack it. So in Russia, they master both things, then choose how to use those skills.
The Russian attacks, they look more professional, and malware and design of the attacks is more complicated and more technical.
Yevgeny Kaspersky has made his name battling cyber criminals, but even he has a grudging respect for Russian hackers.
I think that it's the same why Russian software engineers are recognized as probably the best software engineers in the world. And we, as a software company, we're very happy with Russian technical universities because their students, they are probably the best.
The young IT experts who emerge then could be the Kaspierskis of the future. They could just as easily join the ranks of Russia's criminal hackers for hire.
That report from the BBC's Sarah Rainsford in Siberia. We're going to take a 30-second break, and up next, former Special Prosecutor Ken Starr on the debate over that Liz Cheney ad asking the Justice Department to out lawyers who may have represented detainees. That's just 30 seconds here and now. That ad from the Liz Cheney, William Crystal Group, Keep America Safe, is getting more reaction today. Released on the internet, the ad questions the loyalty of current Justice Department lawyers who'd once done legal work on behalf of terrorist detainees, and also asks Attorney General Eric Holder to change his stance and name them.
Who did President Obama's Attorney General Eric Holder hire? 9 lawyers who represented or advocated for terrorist detainees. Who are these government officials? Eric Holder will only name 2. Why the secrecy behind the other 7?
Well, after the ad came out, Fox News named the other 7 and pointed out that the Bush administration also hired lawyers who'd represented detainees. And several conservative lawyers signed a letter denouncing the ad. Former Special Prosecutor Kenneth Starr was one of them. He led the investigation that led to former President Bill Clinton's impeachment. He's now dean of Pepperdine University's School of Law and joins us from his office. So, Dean Starr, why did you decide to sign this letter and speak out against the ad?
Well, Robin, it's very important for lawyers to be willing to respond to the call to serve unpopular causes. But the fundamental problem with the ad, which is an attack ad, is that it simply overlooks the fact that lawyers have an ethical obligation consistent with the highest traditions of our profession to represent unpopular causes. So they should be commended and not condemned.
Well, and does it also to you imply that if they represented a detainee in the past, they somehow are on the side of the detainees?
That's the implication. It's not said outright. And if you represent a bank robber, you don't approve of bank robbery. If you represent someone charged with a murder, you don't love murder. But rather, in our system, everyone deserves his or her day in court with counsel. And so that is a part of our legal tradition that the ad kind of tugs at and ignores. Namely, you don't impute the cause of the client to the lawyer who's representing the client.
Former Bush speechwriter Mark Thiessen, who supports the ad, supports it for exactly the reason that you don't support it. He wrote in a Washington Post opinion piece, if you'd heard that mob lawyers had been hired in the Justice Department to handle mob cases or drug cartel lawyers had been hired to do drug cases, wouldn't you want to know who they were and what they've been working on?
Well, if someone has been representing the tobacco industry, does that mean that they're for tobacco? One of the reasons that I chose to speak out is because of the ancient traditions of our profession, illustrated powerfully by John Adams representing those charged with murder in the Boston Massacre. And that, again, for John Adams, he turned out okay, didn't he? But it was not a career-enhancing move. But he said and wrote later that was one of the proudest moments of his life, to defend those who otherwise would have gone defenseless.
Well, you just said, though, that maybe you want to be sure that people don't have an agenda. Does the Cheney Group have a point? Why keep the name secret?
Well, except this is simply, it seems to me, a dangerous example of bringing public pressure and possibly shame, who knows, threats to bear against lawyers who responded to the call to do their duty as lawyers. So I do have a great respect for Congress and oversight, but the thrust of this ad was really to attack, I believe, the integrity of the Justice Department and the integrity of the Attorney General, and I think that's one of the reasons that I got all riled up.
Karl Rove didn't endorse the ad, but he did compare the situation to maybe taking lawyers who'd represented companies guilty of accounting scandals and giving them attorney posts at the Securities and Exchange Commission. So aren't there points where you might want to question somebody's work before they go to a post?
Well, that is a part of the vetting process, and that is why, of course, Congress should engage in oversight with respect to how the Department of Justice is conducted. But again, the danger here is the imputation. You impute the cause of the client to the lawyer who defends, and I think that is very bad for our system. It erodes the great tradition that is so important for the protection of liberty in this country, for lawyers who have to protect unpopular clients to now know that when they do that, not only will they suffer whatever during the course of the representation, but if they are ever interested in public service, this is something that is going to be held up to attack ads. Criticism, substantive criticism and the like, that's very good. We need that. That's the nature of our system. That's the nature of democracy. But to go beyond that and try to destroy people's careers and so forth, I think, is unfair, unfortunate, and it's just leading to an erosion of the culture of civility in this country.
Ken Starr, Dean of Pepperdine University School of Law, who signed a letter denouncing ads attacking Justice Department lawyers who once defended terrorist detainees. Dean Starr, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, let's take a couple of minutes now for some of your thoughts. And many of you enjoyed our talk with Daniel Ellsberg. You'll remember during the Vietnam War, he leaked the damning Pentagon Papers to the New York Times and other newspapers. Tom Marcinko of Phoenix, Arizona, particularly appreciated Ellsberg's complaint that today's media isn't doing its job. Tom writes, "On The Daily Show, CNN's Wolf Blitzer said we should have been more skeptical about Iraq, but I've never heard him say that on his own show." Then there was our visit with Gene Sharp. His books on nonviolent protest have been downloaded by dissidents around the world, including Iranians. Gene runs the two-person Albert Einstein Institution from an old walk-up in East Boston, which struck Colleen McGrath, now of Rockport, Mass. She writes, "I used to live nearby, and for 12 years I walked past that building every day and wondered, what is it? What a jewel we have in East Boston. He needs our help. Can we have a bake sale? A walk?" Well, you can do whatever you like. We have information on Gene Sharp at our website, hereandnow.org. We've also talked recently about texting and kids, some families texting each other while in the same house. Lori, who works with teenagers in Phoenix, says texting is practically the only way to communicate with them. It's fabulous. And they can't believe the old lady knows how to text. But Nadine Rank of Shanksville, Pennsylvania writes, "We rarely text. I think it's important to mention the economics. Some of these plans cost $100 or more a month, and it's just not in the budget. Our kids know this, and they understand it, and they have no problem with the limits." A couple of quick corrections. David Schaefer wrote, after historian Julian Zelizer said, "After World War II, FDR led the nation to a decisive victory." Well, Dave points out, of course, it was Truman. Julian misspoke. John Rosen of La Jolla, California, and Dale Sellen of Anchorage, Alaska, both wrote to say, "It's not pathos, as I said yesterday, it's..."
"Pathos."
Oh, let's hear that again.
"Pathos."
Don't you love Merriam-Webster's web audio pronunciation feature? And, of course, you. You keep us on our toes. To keep doing so, you can just go to hereandnow.org, click on Contact Us to send an email or call, or scroll down and leave a comment right there, hereandnow.org. And thank you. Back in a minute, Here and Now. Next Friday, that wimpy kid Greg Heffley is coming to a theater near you. Greg, many of you know, is the sometimes morally suspect hero of author and illustrator Jeff Kinney's wildly popular Diary of a Wimpy Kid series. In the movie, human beings embody Jeff's stick figure creations, though Jeff's drawings do pop up. For example, in this scene, they help Greg illustrate his thoughts about the word diary.
Okay, here's the deal. This is not a diary. It's a journal. Yeah, I know what it says on the cover, but it's wrong. My mom won't have to buy this thing. I specifically told her, don't buy anything that says diary on it. And yet, here we are. Do you know what happened if some jerk saw me with this thing?
Sissy!
But if she thinks I'm gonna write down my feelings, she's crazy. I don't have feelings, I have opinions.
Can't wait. We spoke to Greg Heffley's creator, Jeff Kinney, last fall when he published Dog Days, the fourth and latest book in the Wimpy Kid series. The title refers both to his summer and the puppy who, well, forgive me, parents, pees on Greg's pillow. We begin with Jeff's thoughts on his protagonist.
Greg Heffley is a middle school kid. He can be a crummy friend. He could be a bad person. He can also be a good person. I think the light is just shining on him at the wrong moment in middle school. He's sort of a half-formed person. I don't think any of us would have liked to have had their lives documented in the middle school years, and that's what's happening to Greg Heffley.
Well, how would you describe his moral code?
I would say his moral code is whatever's the most convenient for him. He's a bit of a narcissist, but I think that at times you get to see glimpses of the person he's going to become.
Well, and the kid that he is will be familiar to a lot of people. He wants to tear open his birthday cards and shake all the money out. He racks up a bill at his friend's country club for little, you know, blender drinks. And so he has to get a summer job to pay for it. And he does just a really bad job of mowing lawns, and he confesses to his dad, I'm just really trying to find out how to make money without doing anything.
Right.
Is he sort of a slacker, or is he just a kid?
I think he's just a kid. You know, I think Greg Heffley is what I did in writing this character is I tried to remember the way it was to think like a kid and to rationalize everything. And, you know, I sort of brought out the ugliest parts of a person and maybe, you know, maybe even as an adult, my ugliest parts now and just amplified them. I think a lot of kids can read about Greg's story and see themselves in it and have a laugh at how much he acts like them or thinks like them at times.
But then also, is there something else that you're hoping they'll do? You know, maybe laugh at him, but in some way seeing in that mirror someone they really know they don't want to be?
Right. I think that, you know, the moral of the story, if there is one, is to not act like Greg. but I think that kids get that he's not a role model. It was a little bit tricky writing for this character because I knew that he could be a bit of a jerk. Somebody once said he's like Larry David as a kid, and I thought that was a pretty good analogy.
Larry David, who was on the program recently,
right,
from Curb Your Enthusiasm, and he plays kind of a likable curmudgeon.
Right. I think that Larry David is, you know, somehow he walks this tightrope of being a bit of a jerk, but you root for him anyway. So how do you pull that off? I was a little bit worried that people wouldn't like the book because how can you latch onto this character who doesn't always do the right thing? But I think Larry David's proved it on Curb Your Enthusiasm, and I'm trying to prove it in print.
Well, and you've had some critics, wildly popular sales, but then the New York Times tells us about a posting on Amazon. This person writes, the words moron, jerk, dork, and hot girls are used in the first five pages, complains
right.
One reviewer. This is a poor choice for good character building in your kids.
The adults who are writing that, and it is always, you know, only adults who write those kinds of comments, I think they're missing the joke, actually, is that all of the humor in the books comes from Greg's shortcomings. And so I think that kids know that, and I feel comfortable that kids are in on the joke.
Well, the Times also quotes child psychologists from Harvard who say, this is capturing the struggle of a child trying to figure out what it means to be a person. They could have added a good person. And we're wondering, too, what you're saying about kids and reading. All Greg Heffley wants to do is make a tent with his blanket, keep the curtains down, watch TV. His mom says he's not reading enough. You know, there are so many millions of people at this point who credit these books with getting their kids reading.
Right, and I wish I could have set out upon that path. I wish I could claim that I set out upon that path, but I didn't. I was trying to write books for adults, actually. I wanted to write one big, fat book that was a nostalgia piece.
Well, actually, you started this online. This was on funbrain.com. At one point, you had 20 million unique readers. So you were writing sort of about nostalgia to adults. Your publisher turns it into a book for kids, but along the way, it sounds like you discovered that adults recognize their childhood in Greg.
Yes, that was one of life's great surprises when my nostalgia piece for adults became a children's series. But what I love is that the book is making its way into people's homes, and then kids and their parents are reading it. And so that's been a big treat for me to hear about that. And I was a big reader as a kid, actually, and I loved Shel Silverstein's books and C.S. Lewis's books, J.R.R. Tolkien's books. And so I think that, if anything, my book might end up being a gateway to more legitimate reading.
Were you influenced by Dennis the Menace when you were a kid?
I was influenced by Dennis the Menace and other comics because one thing that I really like about cartoon characters is that they never age. And there's something about the character being stuck in time that makes the reader feel that they're more accessible and that you can really have a handle on that character.
Right. It's not like you're going to get to the end of the story and there's going to be this big moral arc and Greg right. Heffley learns his lesson.
Right.
That's not going to happen.
That's part of the fun of the books, I think. The reader is expecting an adult to come in at any second and kind of set things right, but an adult never steps in. And I think that's why kids respond to it, is that they can't smell the adult behind the pen.
By the way, is Greg a wimp or a future, you know, subprime mortgage salesman?
Right. I think Greg will grow up to be a very average person. He might not describe himself as a wimp, but, you know, by calling it the wimpy kid on the cover, I was trying to send a message to kids that you're better than this kid, or at least that this kid's no better than you. Because I think a lot of times in children's literature, the protagonist is heroic, but from the outset, you know that this kid is not perfect.
I just want to touch on one other thing. You introduced class issues to Dog Days. It's again about Greg's summer vacation, which they can't have. Mom calls a family meeting, money's tight, so they can't go to the beach. What are you trying to say there about class issues or maybe even the economy?
It was fun to actually weave the current economic crisis into my books and have Greg's family be affected by it. You know, he can't go on a summer vacation, and that results in the forward momentum of the book, is that Greg's mom is trying to create this ideal summer vacation despite not having the resources that the family has had in the past. So, yes, this is kind of a shout-out to all the people who are struggling a little bit.
Yeah. Well, and you have been tremendously successful. You worked as a computer game designer. You still do. You've got these incredible books, two boys and your wife in southeastern Mass. By the way, what do the boys think?
You know, my boys really like the books. My wife reads them to them, and I worry a little bit because my six-year-old kind of absorbs the books at face value. In fact, recently, my wife asked my older son to go outside and ride bikes with her and my younger son, and my older son announced that he's more of an indoor person, which he certainly picked up from Greg Heffley. So maybe we'll put the books away for a few years until he gets that filter.
Now you know how some other parents feel.
Right, yes.